You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We have... Patricia Highsmith left 8,000 pages of diaries and cahiers, but as biographer Joan Shenkar notes in The Talented Miss Highsmith, she forged, fabricated, and altered when necessary, just like her antihero, Tom Ripley. Author Joan Shenkar had access to previously unpublished and undocumented Highsmith material, plus full access to the Highsmith archive. In the New York Times Book Review, the novelist Jeanette Winterson lauded her biography of Highsmith as a biography of clarity and style, a model of its kind. And the LA Times called it dazzling and definitive, a volume as original as its contemptible, miserable, irresistible subject. Joan Shenkar has been called America's most original female contemporary playwright. Truly Wild, her biography of Oscar's interesting niece, Dolly Wilde, was hailed as a revelation, the great story of a life, and of the creation of modern culture. She's been playwright in residence at many universities, artist colonies, and with such experimental theater companies as Joe Chaykin's Winter Project and the Polish Laboratory Theater. And tonight, Joan, the biographer, will host a special encounter with her subject, author Patricia Highsmith. She has added, we have the talents of the wonderful Tony-nominated, Drama Desk, and Obie Award-winning actress Kathleen Chalfant, who will be reading from Patricia Highsmith's work. And some of you may have been lucky enough to have seen Kathleen and Tony Kushner's Angels in America on Broadway, Off-Broadway in Wit, or Nine Armenians, or in her many roles in television. So please join me in welcoming Joan Shenkar and Kathleen Chalfant to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Louise. Is this microphone on? Every American writer begins and continues her education and inspiration in a municipal library. We are thrilled to be here in this temple of learning to present to you some of the information that I found in my 8 years in Highsmith country. This is Patricia Highsmith at 21. Lovely, secretive, desired by many. I want you to take a good look at this photograph while you listen to what she was thinking.
There may be the girl waiting, the kiss in the dark, the whispered word of promise, the sun in the park, or the swans on the lake, the job for me and the job for him. And for him, the flag waving bold and free forever, and over again, the handsome boy meeting lovely girl and all the lovely love pursued and captured. It might all be for the best, but I don't see it that way. I never will. I just don't see it that way. I am married to my mother. I shall never wed another. Obsessions are the only things that matter. Perversion interests me most and is my guiding darkness.
And she just went on from there. You know, I have a feeling this handheld thing is not working. Gordon?
There she is.
Oh, it did. Here is Patricia Highsmith, 3.5 years old, Fort Worth, Texas, where she was born, to a family of slave-owning Alabamians who had come down considerably in the world, running a boarding house. Social acceptance and elevation became very important to her. Here she is, expressing herself thoroughly. This is her grandmother, grandfather. That hand there is the hand of, oh, I've got a pointer. That hand there is the hand of the 12-year-old Patricia Highsmith. We'll see that hand again. Highsmith's mother gave birth to her about 9 days after her divorce, which allowed Patricia Highsmith her whole life long to say that she was a legitimate child, but born out of wedlock. This was the first of hundreds of contradictions that governed her life. I can see I'm going to have trouble with this pointer all evening long. This is Mary Coates Highsmith, Highsmith's mother, the love of her life and also the great hate. Highsmith suspended herself between those contradictions until she died, and they were the most creative circumstance she ever had to live with. Writers who have unhappy childhoods are very, very lucky writers. Highsmith's mysterious father, before his mustache, his marriage, and his desertion of the family, she met him once at 12, again at 17, and worshipped him all her life. He was uncommunicative, seemingly uncaring, and like her mother, was an illustrator. Highsmith, her whole life, drew and painted with her left hand and wrote with her right hand. She was as divided as all those double egos and alter characters in her work. Right down to her cells, she was a double character. Her blood type was type O, which is a type which can mimic type A and type B. So everything she did was susceptible to the doubleness that we can find in her work. Here comes the next slide, I hope. Highsmith's mother, on her honeymoon with the man who gave Highsmith her name, Stanley Highsmith. Another illustrator, just like Patricia, her mother had types. Stanley looked like her first husband, didn't act like him, was very easily controlled. Highsmith met him at 3 1/2, hated him on sight. From the age of 4, she entertained homicidal fantasies about her stepfather, which never abated. And so her portrayals of children are always very interesting. This is not a recipe for happiness. Mary Highsmith brought baby Pat on her honeymoon with her marriage. You can see the child is not happy. Mary doesn't look happy either. Patricia is also uncharacteristically wearing a dress. From the age of about 12, she began to imagine that she was a boy in a girl's body and began to dress that way. This is her cousin Dan. Now, all her cousins were named Daniel. People think that because Patricia Highsmith entertained alternate identities in all her works, that the borders of all her characters were porous, that it was an amazingly original idea or something perhaps that she got from Dostoevsky. Every single person in her family had the same name. Even the dog was called Dan. The one cousin she had who was called Don was always called Dan by mistake. He said he answered to the name. You couldn't escape identity in Highsmith's family. Here she is at 12, deciding that she's a boy in a girl's body. It's an enormously sophisticated decision for her to have taken, and it was one of the most serious influences in her work. Here we go again. Here she is, dressed as though she's going to a point-to-point somewhere in the English countryside. She always dressed beautifully. She ironed when she was nervous. Her shoes were highly polished. And we'll be doing a fashion show in the middle of this in a moment. How many people know who this is? Yes. Judy Holliday, aka Judith Tuveem. This was Highsmith's best friend in high school. Best friend and a little bit more. This was the only picture that she kept of Judy Holliday. This is Judy in the wonderful film Adam's Rib with Kate Hepburn. For 1 second, Judith Holliday appears as a man. And interestingly, this was the photo that Highsmith kept. Highsmith's house on Grove Street. I live right around the corner from it, which may have begun my interest in Patricia Highsmith. That and the fact that I also live in Paris. Highsmith spent most of her long expatriation in France. The 20th century had two wonderful cultural ideas. One of them was called Paris, and the other was called Greenwich Village. And Highsmith partook of both of them very fully. Here she is in college. She went to Barnard College. Her mother paid for everything. She never had to have a job. She was mysterious, beautifully dressed, always making friends with older people. Here she is as editor of her every writer. Every writer in this audience was editor of their college papers. I know this. I was myself. It's just something you do. I want you to notice those penny loafers, the bobby socks, and the calculating expression. Highsmith, in college, began her long, long career of disburdening herself of all her artistic ideas in notebooks, just like this one. To the end of her life, she ordered wherever she was in the world, and she spent half her life outside the United States, she always ordered Columbia University notebooks, complaining regularly of how much they cost. I think they were about 49 cents when she ordered her last notebook. And they're set up always the same. The front of them is always a list of the places she's lived that year. She numbers them, she dates them, and sometimes she puts a little saying on them. This says, "Whoever knows that." In her next notebook, at the age of 51, she began to consider something about children again. And this was just an ordinary writing day for her. And this is from the book.
An ordinary day. On 16 November 1973, a damp, coldish, breaking day in the tiny village of Moncourt, France, Patricia Highsmith, a 52-year-old American writer living an apparently quiet life beside a branch of the Loing Canal, lit up another Gauloise Jaune, tightened her grip on her favorite Parker fountain pen, hunched her shoulders over her roll-top desk. Her oddly jointed arms and enormous hands were long enough to reach the back of the roll while she was still seated, and jotted down in her writer's notebook a short list of helpful activities which small children might do around the house. It's a casual little list. The kind of list Pat liked to make when she was emptying out the back pockets of her mind. And it has the tossed-off quality of an afterthought. But, as any careful reader of Highsmith knows, the time to pay special attention to her is when she seems to be lounging, negligent, or, God forbid, mildly relaxed. There is a beast crouched in every unconcerned corner of her writing mind, and sure enough, it springs out at us in her list's discomfiting title, "Little Crimes for Little Tots," she called it. And then, for good measure, she added a subtitle, "Things Around the House Which Small Children Can Do," such as, 1, tying string across top of stairs so adults will trip. 2, replacing roller skate on stairs once mother has removed it. 3, setting careful fires so that someone else will get the blame if possible. 4, rearranging pills in medicine cabinets. Sleeping pills into aspirin bottle. Pink laxative pills into antibiotic bottle, which is kept in the fridge. 5, rat powder or flea powder into flower jar in kitchen. 6, saw through supports of attic trap door so that anyone walking on closed trap will fall through to stairs. 7, in summer, fix magnifying glass to focus on dry leaves or preferably oily rag somewhere. Fire may be attributed to spontaneous combustion. 8, investigate anti-mildew products in gardening shed. Colorless poison added to gin bottle. In her last writer's journal, penned from the same perch in semi-suburban France, Pat had also spared a few thoughts for children. One of them was a simple calculation. She reckoned that one blow in anger would kill, probably, a child from aged 2 to 8, and that those over 8 would take 2 blows to kill. The murderer she imagined completing this deed was none other than herself. The circumstance driving her to it was a simple one. One situation, maybe one alone, could drive me to murder. Family life. Togetherness.
There we go. This gentleman was one of any number whom she entertained as a possible husband. He was a photographer. He was German. He was extremely sophisticated. He was also homosexual, which did not make him good husband material. But Pat, who preferred women herself, seemed to think it was a good idea for a while. It did not last, but he took some beautiful photographs of her. That's one of them. Again, Patricia Highsmith at 22. Look at that expression. That expression made me believe that she and I could become partners in crime. One of the things that Pat did when she graduated from Barnard College in 1942 was to embark on the longest secret career any American writer has ever had. For 7 years, Patricia Highsmith was the only woman to write for comic books during the golden age of American comics. She was also certainly the only woman to write superhero comics. So again, that whole idea of the alter ego, of the double character, the secret life, a lot of it can be sourced to comics. And this was a favorite comic, a kind of a second-rate superhero, someone, Black Terror, someone gleaned from Superman. Superman had lots and lots of duplicates. But this one got a copy of his own. She certainly wrote stories for this particular issue. This superhero began as a mild-mannered pharmacist. An accident in his pharmacy turned him into someone with superpowers, and you may notice he has a boy sidekick. Very, very important in the comic books of the time. I love this cover. It's quite a famous cover. Why am I having trouble with this clicker? A wartime comic. The comics then were written for propaganda. This superhero, who's a very tiny, tiny little fellow, is called the Destroyer. He looks like he's about to be destroyed by this person. But no, he wasn't destroyed. And you'll notice the colloquial language used then. And here we have the Fighting Yank, another wartime superhero, wearing what appears to be a portobello mushroom on his head, most unfortunately. She wrote a lot of Fighting Yank comics. Jack Buster Johnson, a man with an alter ego. He becomes a killer of nearly the entire Japanese Navy because his best friend Doug, and you can see him right here in the water, his best friend Doug was killed by a Japanese bomb. And every time Jack Buster Johnson kills 10,000 Japanese soldiers, he has a conversation with his friend Doug right there. "I did it for you, old boy," he says. And he's not kidding. This is the only known example of Highsmith's 7 years in the comics. She was so fixed on becoming a classical novelist, even though she was later classified as a crime writer, that she destroyed the hundreds of scenarios she wrote. I found this piece of paper in a forgotten notebook in London, one of the joys of biography, is the things you discover. And it's a graph for an old comic book hero who was called Golden Arrow. And he was fashioned after the Lone Ranger for unknown reasons. And you can see that she's made some drawings, but she's also made a sentence that I wish I could make this pointer do what I want to, but it says, "Spice all this up with detail." And detail is what Highsmith is famous for in her novels. This photograph, anybody recognize these characters? All of them are very important to mid-century America. Gore Vidal, looking impossibly handsome and, as usual, at no one but himself. Tennessee Williams. This is the wonderful painter Buffy Johnson, who, when Pat was in Barnard, became a lover of Pat's. Buffy was a lover of Pat's between her own several marriages. This is the novelist Donald Wyndham, recently dead. And this is the great, late great Tannikeel LeClaire. This is the kind of society Pat aspired to when she was in college, and thus her cultivation of older people. This is the famous Cafe Nicholson in New York, which for 40 years was the center of all high bohemia. I wish I could have gone there. This is Buffy Johnson again in a characteristic pose taken by Edward Weston. She was witty, sophisticated, and very, very rich. Pat's favorite qualities. Another wonderful woman who was the eyes and ears of the Henry Luce Empire. Pat's older friends were always extremely well-placed. The ladder of success in New York is something she understood perfectly. One of the many fabulous Jewish refugees who made friends with Pat and who stayed friends with her all her life. This woman was a performer. Here she is at 90, still doing her performance art. She was a painter. Pat, who busily scribbled anti-Semitisms in her notebook, not as bad as John Galliano, certainly, but was surrounded by Jews all her life. Half her lovers were Jews. All of her mentors were Jews. People, you discover when you're writing biography, are very, very complicated. But while she was scribbling her anti-Semitism, she was also working for Sholem Aleichem's son-in-law, writing articles for the Jewish Free Press all over the world. So, as I said, people are very complicated. We'll talk about that later. Lover of Pat's called Alayla Cornell. This is a famous scene from Greenwich Village where artists used to sit along the gates and paint your picture for a dollar. Here is Pat Highsmith on the Circle Line going around New York and pointing to the New Jersey, I think. Patricia was so ambitious that when she was 25 years old, she set up a graph that charted the various traits of all her important lovers to date. Now, she didn't count any of the men, I notice. These are all 10 women whose names have been obscured for obvious reasons. But you can see she set them up as to body type, as to hair type, the length of time the relationship lasted, the advantageousness of the relationship, how long it went on after it ended. And in due, she says, to my lack of sympathy, and due to her lack of sympathy, her conclusion was that she lacked sympathy, actually. But the fact that a 25-year-old girl would qualify and quantify her relationships in that way give you an idea of her very strange attachment to the American dream, which was to better yourself in every way. This is Yaddo. Everybody here know what Yaddo is? This is the artist colony to which she ended up, to everyone's shock, leaving her rather large fortune. And she did it in the last few weeks of her death. She spent 8 fabulously drunken weeks here in 1948, reworking her first novel, Strangers on a Train, which, if you have not read it, please go out and do so, and preferably in the edition which I edited for Norton. But it's a mid-century American masterpiece. She did a great deal of work here and got engaged to this rather dishy British novelist who the engagement, of course, didn't last, but out of it came a book of his called The Choice, in which he restaged their relationship very interestingly, and a book of hers called The Price of Salt, which we're going to get to in a minute. Pat Highsmith always had murder on her mind. The Price of Salt is the one book in which she didn't kill anyone, and we're going to talk about it in a second. Now, this is a famous picture from the Hitchcock film of Strangers on a Train, which she was working at Yaddo. Hitchcock bought the film for not a lot of money, but it was an extraordinary coup for a 28-year-old writer. The film was made a year after the book was published. The book was published in 1950. Highsmith never met Hitchcock, wouldn't go near the film. She, I think, felt that way about all the films that were made of her works. She wanted the money, she got the money, she didn't. Tried to avoid the film. While she was waiting for the publication of Strangers on a Train, she took a job at Bloomingdale's in the toy department, a very unusual choice for someone who felt about children the way she felt. And one day, a married woman from New Jersey walked into the toy department. That woman, Kathleen Wiggins Senn, moneyed, lovely, ordered a toy for her daughter, and Highsmith fell in love. And here's the story.
In the Christmas season of 1948, the winter weather in Manhattan was freakishly warm, the warmest ever recorded by the New York Weather Bureau. It wasn't until mid-December that the first major snowstorms blanketed the city and quickly turned to municipal slush under a day of heavy rains. Pat Highsmith, perhaps it was the unseasonable heat, was alight with one of her special holiday feelings. She wanted to close her hands tightly, she thought, around the throat of a blondish and elegant married woman from New Jersey who had just bewitched her from across a crowded room. Kathleen Senn, the married woman in question, resplendent in a mink coat, appeared one day in early December in the 7th floor toy department at Bloomingdale's, where Pat, awaiting the publication of her novel Strangers on a Train, had just taken a sales job for the Christmas rush season. Beautifully coiffed, statuesque, with an angled Saxon profile and intelligent gray eyes, Mrs. Sen, slapping a pair of gloves suggestively into the palm of one hand, walked slowly and absently up to the doll counter where a mesmerized young Pat Highsmith stood waiting to serve her in a voice that class-conscious Americans like Pat would have recognized as being full of money. Mrs. Sen ordered a doll sent to her house in Ridgewood, New Jersey, for one of her daughters. The enthralled young sales girl, Miss Highsmith, filled out the receipt, but her alter ego, the criminally inclined writer, Patricia, quickly memorized the client's address. In a trance of desire, Pat, both parts of her, went straight downstairs to the Bloomingdale's card shop, bought a Christmas card, signed it with the perfect Highsmith nom de plume, and mailed it off at the post office in Bloomingdale's basement to Kathleen Sen's address. The signature Pat put on the card wasn't a name. It was her Bloomingdale's employee number. To an imagination like Patricia Highsmith's, Kathleen Sen's routine transaction in Bloomingdale's, it lasted, Pat wrote, no more than 2 or 3 minutes, and she never saw Mrs. Sen again, had all the features of a sexually charged sadomasochistic fantasy. On one side of the Bloomingdale's counter was the young, poor, subservient sales girl. On the other side, the older, wealthy, dominant Venus in furs. Money and class were not the least of the elements in Pat's stunned attraction for Kathleen Sen, and her obsession at first sight struck her like a lightning bolt or like a religious experience. The woman seemed to give off light. I felt odd and swimmy in the head, near to fainting, yet at the same time uplifted, as if I'd seen a vision. After her meeting with Mrs. Sen, Pat went directly back to her apartment, wrote up a plot outline for The Price of Salt. It flowed from my pen as from nowhere, beginning, middle, and end, in 2 hours, and then fell ill with a disease most often associated with children, chicken pox. One of the small, runny-nosed children in the toy department must have passed on the germ to me, but in a way, the germ of a book, too. Fever is stimulating to the imagination.
The amazing thing about The Price of Salt, the one book in which Highsmith doesn't kill anyone, even a dog. She loved to kill dogs in her books. The one book in which he didn't kill anyone, something happened to the source of her inspiration 6 months before The Price of Salt was published. And remember, Kathleen Sen and Highsmith never met each other again. 6 months before the book was published, Kathleen Sen walked into her garage, turned on the ignition, and killed herself. It was as though the fact that Highsmith crossed her path made her an extra textual murderer. It's everyone I talked to about Highsmith told me that she was able to cast about her the darkness that she had in her. She had a very powerful, and in fact, everyone around her began to behave like criminals at one point or another, including the author of her biography. I won't make any confessions now. I did write a little piece for the Paris Review about it. You can Google it if you like. You can't help it. There's an extraordinary criminal aura that seems to circle around this woman, and you're sucked right into it, that endless circle of noir. Anyway, poor Mrs. Sen seemed to have felt that aura and killed herself. The book, The Price of Salt, one of 5 or 6 Highsmith's novels that I think are her best. Although it's a love story, and it starts just the way that meeting did that I wrote about in the book and that Kathleen has performed for you so beautifully, that book carries murder in every metaphor. The love affair is like the pursuit and capture of one criminal for another. It's a fascinating book, and again, something you could read with great pleasure. Oh yeah, I have to use this now. All right, next. This is a graph. Highsmith loved to make maps, charts, plans, and graphs, and I published a lot of them in this book because I think it's interesting to see the way a writer's mind works. Here's a chart she made for The Price of Salt. You can see how everything is calculated. Here she is with her favorite cat, Spider. Spider Highsmith. She dedicated a book to Spider. Spider miraculously ended up in the care of the late, great Muriel Spark, who had wonderful things to say to me about Spider Highsmith. She said that Spider had clearly been a writer's cat. He knew how to go and sit on a manuscript when that book was finished and tell you that it was finished. Pat lived with cats all her life, various successes, but they were very strong relationships for her. She has a fine short story in which a cat kills someone, too. Again, another unusually intelligent Jewish refugee who was a longtime lover of Pat's, their relationship was so fraught. They argued from Trieste to Paris, from Venice to Bucharest. They fought across the United States and back. And out of that relationship came four of Pat's best novels, including The Talented Mr. Ripley. There was something about conflict that she simply adored. You thought that The Talented Mr. Ripley was a name she made up. Well, everybody remember Ripley's Believe It or Not? It was one of the most circulated comics. It's not exactly a comic strip. It was a kind of a world of wonder. As I tracked Pat as she moved around the United States writing The Talented Mr. Ripley, every town in which she stopped and every paper that she read in this town ran Ripley's Believe It or Not. Now, she always said she named Ripley's after a store which sold menswear in New York. And it's true, there was a menswear store called Ripley's, but certainly Ripley's Believe It or Not was quite a factor in the titling of that book. Next, and here is the gorgeous Alain Delon playing, I think, against Maurice René in the first film made of The Talented Mr. Ripley. It was made in France by Claude Autant-Laurat, and it was called Plein Soleil, Purple Noon. It has almost nothing to do with the book, but Delon is so beautiful you can't help watching it. Here is Pat when she fell in love with a woman in England. That was the only reason she moved anywhere. She fell in love every day of her life, which is one of the most delightful things about her. She lived for love. No American novelist has committed so many crimes for love as Patricia Highsmith did. And because her psychology was not like any others, whenever she thought of love, she also thought of murder. Here she is in her house in Suffolk. She loved animals. While she was living in Suffolk, she sometimes worked for the BBC. And let's bring back Mary Highsmith, the most important character in her life. When she was working for the BBC, she used to visit a friend of hers, whose name I have disguised for many reasons. And here's that story.
On the other side of London, in a leafy part of Kensington, is a lovely old house with steps that curve like a castle staircase from the walk in its front yard to the top of the house's final floor, and there lives another friend of Pat Highsmith. Let us call her Camilla Butterfield. Camilla Butterfield's house is filled with books and comfortable corners. Woodcuts are on the wall, and out in back there is a fragrant, well-tended garden whose green shade gives a slightly aquarium cast to the ground floor. Pat has just lunched at Mrs. Butterfield's, leaving her white English Volkswagen parked in the drive while she goes off to do some business at the BBC. Suddenly, the telephone rings at Mrs. Butterfield's house, and it proves to be an unsettling call. It is Pat's mother, Mary Coates Highsmith, always well provided with the coordinates of Pat's friends and lovers, and she has arrived in London from the United States with rather less warning than the Blitz. In a distinctively deep southern voice, unplaceable, says Mrs. Butterfield, as to social class, and very upset, Mary begins this long, terrific series of complaints in a deep southern voice all about Pat and everything else. She was neglected, she said, and Pat knew she was coming to London. Well, I don't know that Pat did know she was coming. So I told her that Pat was at the BBC and that I would give Pat the message immediately when she came back. When Pat returned from the BBC to pick up her car, Camilla Butterfield, privy to Pat's version of the tangled emotional relations between the Highsmith mother and daughter, opened the door and greeted Pat jauntily. "Brace yourself," she announced. "The Deep South has arrived." And Pat fainted away right on the doorstep. It was incredible, and it was more than a faint. Her legs just gave way. She just crumpled into a heap on top of herself, like a doll, so to speak. I've never seen anything like it. Pat recovered herself quickly, and despite the fact that she was driving back to Islington, Mrs. Butterfield poured her a large drink, then gave her Mary's message and the telephone number. But Pat didn't ring her mother. She drove straight back to North London. Camilla Butterfield discovered subsequently that Pat and Mary were in touch, and so I invited them to tea. It was brave of me, but I was curious. When Mrs. Butterfield's husband came back to Kensington from work at about 6 o'clock on the afternoon of the tea party, Mrs. Butterfield said, "He found me in a state of shock. After Pat and Mary Highsmith had gone, the air quivered, and I just sat on. My husband came in. He had no idea anyone had been in the house, and he said to me, 'You look as though you've been through an earthquake. Take me out to dinner.' I said, 'I have.'" Camilla Butterfield says that she sat motionless for about 20 minutes after Mary and Pat left her house. So the tea party couldn't have lasted very long, perhaps an hour and a half. But it was, Mrs. Butterfield thought, quite long enough. The atmospheric pressure of the room was incredible. It seemed like a disturbance in the air had passed through the house and torn everything apart. I felt as though I'd been in a thunderstorm. Well, of course, Pat and Mary were mutually antagonistic, but they were also both very rattled. It was chaos, just chaos. Everywhere things were put down out of place. I made quite a nice formal tea party for them. I'd gone to quite a lot of trouble. And when they'd finished, when they'd gone, there was a teacup here and a saucer over there and a bit of sandwich there, a tree strainer here, and an olive in a plant. And the ashtray, well, it was chaos. After that, I think they went straight back to Suffolk, and there were dreadful scenes there. 4 years earlier, Mary Highsmith had written to her daughter, "I believe you would gladly put me in Dachau if it were possible, without a minute's thought." And Pat told her cousin Dan that during Mary's visit to her in Suffolk, she had locked up her writing at night out of instinct because she was certain her mother meant to destroy it.
A 44-year-old daughter who thinks her mother's going to destroy her life's work and a 65-year-old mother, who believes her daughter's going to put her in a concentration camp, have entered what Jean Genet used to refer to as the universe of the irremediable. And that's pretty much where they stayed all their lives. It was a relationship forged in hell. It should have been made in heaven. They were terribly alike. They could not bear each other's company, and they could not stand to be apart. Mysterious diseases, exactly the same disease, would strike them when they were at opposite ends of the earth. It's an extraordinary relationship and very painful to see, and also very interesting. 20 years before her death, Pat cut off, finally, all relations with her mother, and her writing declined precipitously. The moment she lost that irritation in the oyster, she stopped producing the pearl. It's one of the side effects of being a writer. Writing is not for sissies. Can we? I don't think I'm operating these slides anymore. I think it's Gordon. Ah, this is a wonderful story. This is one of Patricia Highsmith's friends to your right, an English actress named Heather Chasen. She is playing in a play with Dame Sybil Thorndike, one of the grand dames of the British stage. This play, written by Enid... Somebody remind me of her name. Close enough. Was called Call Me Jackie, about a homicidal, psychopathic lesbian. And Pat's friend decided to base her role on Pat. And so she dressed as Pat, she acted as Pat. It was perfect, she said. She'd never done better on stage. And this is a photo from that play. Can we have the next photo? This is Pat with, anyone recognize this? Arthur Koestler. They had a little entanglement early on in Pat's career. They were certainly dark enough for each other, and all his life he praised her work. But he was such an efficient seducer, he decided early on that really she was truly dedicated to women and he just wouldn't bother. But they remained friends their whole lives. Next, please. Ah, now comes the fashion show. This is Pat in her trademark Levi 501s that she wore everywhere in Europe and used to order from Texas all the time. And here they are. Every element of her character is visible in these jeans. You can see, if Kathleen will only slow down for a moment, she's got that. Oh, all right. You can see the tiny Boy Scout stitches she took. So long were her legs, she had to let those jeans out. They're 36 inches long. They come up to my neck. She still had to let them out. So frugal was she, and by then she was earning really good money. She bleached the hell out of them, yet Cloroxed them, used them over and over and over again, darned them. They contain what her friend Janet Flanner used to call the specific invisible remains of character. And it's one of the delights of writing biography is to find things like this. This was actually given to me by a friend of Pat's. But to actually, I'm a big believer in putting your hands on material, which is why this, and now here's another little display, just to remind you of the wonderful vices that writers used to have. They used to drink a lot. They used to smoke a lot. And they used to write with fountain pens. This fountain pen, which is a 1948 Esterbrook steel-nibbed pump action, is exactly like the pen. This was also a gift, a publication gift from a friend. This is the pen that Pat used to write with. That is to say, it's an exact double. And the joy of once again taking up a fountain pen is incomparable. Let me recommend it. Can we have the next slide, please? Now, this tells you everything about Patricia Highsmith you need to know. Here's her favorite 1956 coffee-colored Olympia Deluxe typewriter. She's smoking a cigarette. How I love to see that. She's got a notebook to her left. She's got everything perfectly arranged in her famous roll-top desk. There's a pack of cigarettes there, and certainly a case of beer under the desk. She was both alcoholic and hypergraphic, which means she left behind her a lot of messes and a lot of interesting work. Next, please. Another Jewish lover of Pat's, Marion Abudaram, a French novelist. They were together in Pat's favorite, the house she loved so much in France, which when she sold it, she tried to buy it back the next day. Ambivalence was almost a credo with her. She regretted selling that house all her life. Next, please. This was the woman she left Marion for, a German performance artist, 25 years old, half Pat's age, who was also a costume designer. And remember, Pat's mother was a fashion illustrator. So there's an interesting link. Here she is, Tabea Blumenschein, impersonating a girl. Next, please. And here she is impersonating a boy. So very interesting for Patricia. It engaged all her extremities. Next, please. Here is Pat with the young woman who helped her to recover from Tabea Blumenschein, another 25-year-old named Monique Buffet. Pat is looking very happy because she's just had Monique impersonate her agent. So anything to do with impersonation, forgery, inauthenticity, delighted Patricia Highsmith. She was as good as Oscar Wilde on the fine art of forgery, and I think she took some lessons from him. Next, please. Ah, the Fortress of Solitude. This was Pat's last house in Switzerland. Oh, we're good on time. She helped to design it. It looks like, you know, a prison, a bunker. And naturally, she wasn't happy in it. Next, please. I rest my case. She did, however, stage this photo herself in front of all her pointed instruments. She is ceaselessly creative. She made furniture. She did sculpture. She constructed assemblages. She drew and painted all her life. She had always to be doing something. So here she is in front of all her instruments of construction. Next, please. On the cover of Ellery Queen about the same year, 1990. Next. Here she is with her friend. Who can tell me who this is? Exactly. She's dying here. And because she was Pat Highsmith, she couldn't just die of one disease. She had to die of two competing diseases. You couldn't treat one without exacerbating the other. So she simply declined quite slowly and then very rapidly. But 2 months before her death, here she is in France for her publicity for her last novel. She never stopped working. Next. The only country to put up a plaque for Patricia Highsmith was France. Perfect. It's a dead end, impasse. But they put it up 1,500 yards past her house. So it's in front of the wrong house. Next. And here she is at 26 in the famous photograph by a dear friend of hers, another Jewish refugee, Ruth Bernard, the great photographer of American nudes who did a lot of work here in California. Here she is at the height of her powers and thought and even her beauty. And when I went to visit her grave, which is something anyone writing about a life does, in the little churchyard in Switzerland, remember all her life she inveighed against the Catholics, not only against the Jews, but against the Catholics. So she's buried in a Catholic cemetery. Her ashes are in an urn, in a niche in the wall. That little niche is filled with yahrzeit pebbles from her Jewish admirers. So here she is again in death, suspended in that great ambivalence that allowed her to do all her creativity. And I thought it was the most perfect end for anyone I'd ever seen.
Any moment now, she might hitch up her chair to the big roll-top desk, pluck a smoldering Gauloisian from the edge of the ashtray for one last inspirational drag, then raise those huge hands over the keyboard of the coffee-colored Olympia typewriter and begin to strike the keys with a sound like little pistol shots. Busy as always with her daily work, the work of a serious writer about to add a new terror to the world. When Pat was 26 years old and still alight with 100 new ideas a day, still attracting lovers like a magnet, still writing for the comics, still having the time of her life in a Manhattan where the American dream was still vibrantly alive, she picked up her pen in the early hours of the last day of December 1947 and condensed her hopes for the coming year into a single sentence. She called this little challenge, for that's what it was, a youthful fist raised in the face of fortune, my New Year's toast. She could as easily have called it my epitaph. 2:30 a.m., my New Year's toast. To all the devils, lusts, passions, greeds, envies, loves, hates, strange desires, enemies ghostly and real, the army of memories with which I do battle, may they never give me peace. They never did.
Thank you.
That novel from the 50s, which you talked about, why was it called Price of Salt? I've read the novel and I've never been able to figure out. And also, was it published at all when she wrote it? Because
absolutely. The novel was called The Price of Salt. I managed to track down a quotation in Gide, whom she was reading, and the great counterfeiter himself. She loved the idea. He had taken it from a biblical quotation, and she picked it up and incorporated it. It is now published under the title Carol. The story of her writing it upset her so much to write. It was a book, she said, that came from her own bones, and it upset her so much to write in her own voice. That's the closest she ever got to her own voice, that she couldn't publish it under her own name. She published it under a pseudonym, and when in 1990 Bloomsbury Press finally persuaded her to publish it under her own name, she changed the title. Something about that book had to be in disguise always. Plus, she dedicated it to three people who never existed. So something about it had to be forged. She had to keep it at a slight remove from her. It was so personal.
Very much, but I'm very curious how the two of you got together to produce this, because I think it's fascinating.
Oh, thank you. Kathleen, why don't you speak to that?
Well, Joan and I have been friends since 1978. Joan wrote a wonderful play about Alice James, among other things. And it was produced at the Women's Project, and I played Alice James, and we were friends then, and we've been friends in the theater all this time, and then and just friends, neighbors in the village, and all. And Joan wrote the book, and people liked it a lot, and it was all over the Times, and she was invited to do a reading at Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side and asked me if I would be part of the reading. And then Joan, because she's a playwright, made the show. So I just read, and this is the script. So that's what happened, and we've done it 4 times now?
I think so, and it's different every time.
A little different every time. But I have the easy part, because I just get to read the good parts. Sorry?
Yes, I know that there was a production of The Talent of Mr. Ripley for the BBC when she was working there. Do you know if that still exists somewhere?
Well, recently there was a... there's a radio version, if that's what you're talking about. BBC Four? I just heard it, actually. I'm sure it's archived. If you go, do you listen to BBC Four on the internet? Easy to find. It can be found.
Hello. Every now and then you mention sadomasochism, which I'm perfectly comfortable with. Are you sure she wasn't actually more dominant than submissive? Was she just thinking she was submissive? Well, topping from the bottom or something?
Well, I think, you know, any, first of all, any biographer who tries to follow her subject into the bedroom is a fool. Unless you were there with camera lights and microphones, or someone was under the bed, you never know what's going on. In her life, like everyone else, Pat always thought she was a victim. Quite the contrary, I think. So everybody felt victimized, which I guess that's love. And or some version of it. Like most writers, she did much better with her work than she did with her life. Though people are oddly fond of her. And now we're quite matey. I spent 8 years in Highsmith country, out of my mind half the time, because although I love women who go too far, Highsmith really goes too far. But she's just the most fascinating psychology I've ever kept company with, and well worth looking at. She put me on my mettle. In order to deliver her in a book, I had to invent a whole new form for biography. This book is organized according to her obsessions. It's not organized chronologically, although it includes a long chronology in an appendix, so you get every fact. But because it focuses on her obsessions, it really brings her up. And that's how obsessed people work anyway. You don't think from moment to moment or day to day. Everything that concerns you is chasing itself around in your head. So it seemed to work very well.
Can you tell me what the thing is with the snails?
One day, Pat told two stories about snails. One was that they were both about her walking past a market on the Upper West Side. There were snails copulating. She didn't know they were copulating, but they were copulating. I don't know how snails copulate, but it's apparently a very lengthy process. And she thought she would, 4.5 hours, she thought she would save them from the, you know, ending up on someone's dinner plate. And she took them home. And she just got very, very interested in them. When you think about it, the woman who could build that fortress of solitude would quite naturally admire someone who carried their house on their back. The most tender love scene she ever wrote is between two snails. And it's in a very, very, very interesting book called Deep Water, another one of her 5 or 6 really stunning novels. She wrote, her consciousness is not like any other Americans. And I really, really suggest that you read her if you have not. I'm sorry.
We take 2 or 3 more questions.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, we don't want to keep you too long here. We've got some questions. Yes, we'll get you.
Where are her papers, and did she put restrictions on how they could be used? Did she censor herself at all?
No, that's the really, well, anyone who keeps a diary does not do so innocently. When you write, when a writer keeps a diary, it's because she wants it to be read eventually. She kept both diaries and notebooks, and the diaries are rather sensational. They're simmering. They're all her love affairs and more, but shaped by a writer, may I say. And the notebooks, of which you saw one, are her artistic essays, and they're very interesting. All her novels start in those notebooks. Her papers, just my luck, are in one of the most expensive cities in Europe, Bern, Switzerland. They were sold to the National Library of Switzerland. They are the property of the Swiss people. They are 150 linear feet in length. I had to go through every one of those feet. And because she was hypergraphic, she kept everything except her comic book material, which she utterly destroyed except for that sole sheet. So she has maybe one of the largest, it's probably the last large archive of the 20th century. And I was lucky enough to get permission to go through the whole thing. Plus all the furniture she made, all the paintings and drawings she did, the assemblages, the frightening little sculptures. Oh, it's quite interesting. And the knives she collected. Yes. Hi, Howard.
Hello, Joan.
Nice to see you.
The pleasure's mine. You talk about how she kept at arm's length the film adaptations of her own work. But in her novel, The Tremor of Forgery, my favorite, about a screenwriter named Howard, she seems to really understand the collaboration between a writer and director and understand all kinds of, not the mechanics of, but the nuances of the relationships among people making a film very, very well. Do you know if she ever experienced any of this firsthand?
She did try once to write with a French director a film. She did an adaptation of her novel for him. He committed suicide after trying to work with her, and he never paid her, and she really held it against him. So, what you're bringing out, actually, and you know, the best way to access Highsmith is by humor, and that's what I try to do in this book. When someone is as extreme as she is, the real way to understand her is to be able to laugh with her. And I started laughing about halfway through doing this and had a great deal of fun. She's very good on professions and occupations. She really understands what work means. No one worked harder than Highsmith. And she was able to enter into many different shocking occupations. If you look at her books, all the people who are employed do different things. And she's got those particulars down just microscopically. Another question?
I wanted to ask about the later books. I agree that they maybe weren't as strong as the early ones, but one of the later ones that I really liked was Found in the Street.
Uh-huh.
And I think that you both lived in that area. Did you have any thoughts or comments about that book?
Yeah. I dealt with it by I decided to adopt Highsmith's methods, which were doing graphs and maps and... So I made a map of all the murders in her New York novels, where they took place. And then I coordinated it with the information I found out about where she lived with her lovers. And wouldn't you know it, every place she killed someone in a novel was a place she made love in life. This is a woman who was so psychologically coherent that you couldn't help it. I enjoy that novel because of the village scene, and I understand every bit about it. But because she had been out of the United States so long by then, it's very dislocated. All the things she describes about New York couldn't possibly take place, and the locations are perfect, but her understanding is 20 years out of date, so it makes it even stranger. I like that. One of the dangers of being an expatriate, which I am, and which is why I come back to the United States so often. Are we done? Louise says
thank,
we're done.
Joan and Kathleen for a fabulous evening. Please give them a hand. We'll join you in the lobby in just a moment. And thank you so much. Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.